Welcome back to Immunity by Design, where we bring together leading scientists, biotech innovators, and representatives of policymakers or funding bodies to explore how emerging technologies and AI are reshaping our understanding of immunology. I'm Hashem Kui, an Associate Professor of Systems Immunology at the University of Oxford, and I am delighted to be hosting this series. Today, I'm truly honored to be joined by Dr. Agni Antanavisute, one of the corresponding authors of a seminal paper published in Nature titled Spatial Fibroblast Niches Define Crohn's Fistula. Crohn's disease is a chronic inflammatory condition of the gut affecting roughly one in every 650 people. In around 30 to 40% of patients, the disease takes a particularly destructive turn. Ulcers eat through the wall thickness of the bowel wall and burrow outward, creating abnormal tunnels called fistula that can connect the intestine to the skin, bladder, vagina, or other organs. These are particularly painful, frequently infected, and profoundly damaging the quality of life. In this paper, Agni and her colleagues set out to investigate the molecular and cellular basis of this devastating complication, and by doing so, they have produced the largest and most detailed cellular and molecular atlas of human intestinal fistula ever constructed. Welcome on board, Agni.
Hi, Hashem, and thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you on board. Perhaps to start with, would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us about your interest and the mission you are on.
So I'm primarily a computational biologist. I say primarily. I think I like to keep my toes in the wet lab. So I would describe myself maybe as a damp biologist, not a dry or a wet lab one. So I'm really interested both in the biology of the intestine, and in particular in development and inflammatory diseases. But at the same time, I think my passion really is big data and really looking at large multimodal data sets and trying to put together pieces of the puzzle and see what we can learn about various diseases or development or how really cells come together and form tissues or how these processes go wrong in disease.
Awesome. With this introduction, let's put one step back and look into the gap in the knowledge that made you towards this study. You and the team have spent a good number of years gathering data and studying this devastating disease. In the light of this, can you describe what a fistula actually is, what it feels like to be a patient living with one, and why it represents such a distinct and serious complication of Crohn's disease?
I think you've already done a really good job introducing what fistulae are. So, I mean, really just to repeat what you said. So a fistula is really an abnormal tunnel that connects different body surfaces that normally wouldn't be connected and normally weren't supposed to connect. And so in Crohn's disease, during long-term ongoing chronic inflammation, fistula can form between intestine and other parts of the body. So it can form between two different parts of the intestine, small and large intestine, for example. It can connect the intestine to the skin. This often happens perianally, or it can connect the intestine to other organs, such as bladder or vagina. And really what this means is that you end up with this, often non-healing tunnel, which causes pain, recurrent abscesses, cycles of infection, obviously, repeat hospital visits for the patients, and sometimes major surgery because the fistula don't or often don't heal on their own. And as you can imagine, it affects a patient's daily life, from basic comfort to the ability to work and move. And I think a large part of a disease really is also the sort of you know, the social aspects of living with Crohn's disease, because you constantly have to be on the lookout for a bathroom. It's not something that is comfortable to talk about. You know, often people can feel embarrassed by it. And so it's something that quite often people don't really hear about, because just because of, you know, the stigma that can be associated with it as well, which I think is very, very unfair, and maybe why we also don't put enough resources towards studying these aspects of the disease.
I completely agree. It's a very awful disease. So as we spoke, fistula affect up to 40% of Crohn patients and can be utterly life-changing. Yet for decades, the field had a limited idea of what was actually happening at the cellular and molecular level inside the tunnels. What made them so difficult to study, and why had no one built this kind of atlas before?
So fistula are obviously really complicated structures, and no two fistula are really the same. Because they happen between different parts of the body, they can form really complicated branching structures, and they're very heterogeneous in general. Having sufficient access to tissue samples that would power a large study is number one challenge. Obviously, samples can really come from patients undergoing surgery, and they have to be donated, and there needs to be very close clinical collaboration between scientists and clinicians and data analysts to actually achieve a study like this. All of these are really strong barriers. We also don't have very good models for the disease. So for a lot of diseases and slightly less complicated forms of IPD, we do have very good animal models, for example, mouse models. We also have in vitro tissue models. But for fistula, these don't really exist, which make any functional studies of the disease really, really hard. You know, in combination with difficult to access tissue, very complicated disease, and very, very poor animal and in vitro models, I think really this combines to make it a very, very understudied disease. In our study, we've really come together at least on looking at the human side, we really managed to take advantage of close collaborations between clinicians and basic scientists and computational biologists to really overcome some of these barriers and you know, look at the pathology at slightly larger scales than before.
Create quite a lot of barriers to overcome. That makes perfect sense. So before this paper, what was the leading hypothesis about how fistula is formed? My shallow understanding is that there were some older work on epithelial to mesenchymal transition. Were those ideas on the right track or partially right, or there was something else in place?
So there's a substantial body of older literature that alludes to epithelial to mesenchymal transition. So the idea was that you would have damage in the epithelial barrier, and epithelial cells, in attempting to repair the barrier, would acquire these almost, you know, cancer-like properties, which would then enable them to migrate and abnormally create fistula. This was something that we started with initially at the outset, and actually we spent a very, very long time looking for any evidence of EMT in our own data before eventually stepping back from that idea, because We couldn't really find anything in our data that would support that. We couldn't really see any epithelial cells at the leading edge of the fistula where the barrier was damaged that would look like they might be undergoing EMT. But what's interesting is that many of the genes that we did see that would be linked to, for example, you know, invasiveness and migration and tissue remodeling, which do strongly overlap these programs, we saw them in our fibroblast populations. And so we think, those initial ideas were not completely wrong because similar pathways are activated. I think just the cellular source of them was probably misinterpreted slightly. The hypothesis that fistula themselves start from the intestinal lesions that fail to heal is also not entirely, it's not entirely new. What we found in a work that fistula might actually start from the basis of intestinal ulcers. It makes sense with our data. And this hypothesis also previously existed in literature. So I think we just found some further evidence to really prop it up.
That's interesting. The way you described actually leads very nicely to my next question. That is, for those unfamiliar with gut cellular composition, firstly, what is a fibroblast normally doing in a healthy intestinal tissue? And then the question is that why would anyone have suspected these quiet structural cells of being the central players in fistula formation?
Fibroblasts are fascinating and actually really multifunctional. You think of a fibroblast, especially in a gut, as having the main function would be to form the extracellular matrix and contribute to the structure formation. Obviously, different parts of your gut need different types of extracellular matrix with different mechanical properties. It needs sponginess and so on. So different specialized type of fibroblasts exist in different parts of the intestine that support that. But beyond that, fibroblasts do loads of different things. So there's a special type of fibroblast near epithelial barrier that actually provides morphogens to epithelium that really supports epithelial cell differentiation and regeneration. Another really exciting type of fibroblast exists that organizes immune follicles, for example. So these cells help recruit T cells, for instance. So they tell them exactly where to come and hang out, so you can mount really robust adaptive immune responses in your gut. So obviously fibroblasts do loads of really important functions just in healthy environment. And when we think about it in terms of what goes wrong in disease, if you think about a fibroblast that naturally supports healthy immune function, you can see how that can become overactive start encouraging, too much inflammation and lead to an unchecked inflammatory response. You can see how a fibroblast that would normally support epithelial regeneration, for example, can now start supporting abnormal epithelial regeneration in the fistula tract. And we see that there are parallels. A lot of the same molecules are involved. So a lot of the processes that would be part of the normal gut function, if you repurpose them in the wrong context, in the wrong way, that's how you end up with disease pathology.
So with this background, now I want to move on to the results and the observations that you report. Obviously, this is a very rich paper, and if we want to talk about all the findings, it would take ages. But here I have highlighted a few questions that I believe are at the intersection of immunology and data science. To begin with, the paper combines single-cell RNA-seq, Visium, Xenium, multiplex immunofluorescence, and collagen imaging. That is actually a genuinely daunting multimodal data set. Walk us through the core logic, why you needed each of these data sets, and how did they come together?
So I think that's actually been probably the most fun part of the study, having the ability to combine different types of modalities to really look at the pathology of a disease from different angles. I really don't think we would have arrived at the conclusions that we did if we just looked at each data set individually. So obviously single cell sequencing is great because it gives us really an unbiased look at what each individual cell is doing. But we end up losing all of the structural information. We don't know where each cell has come from. And when you're trying to study a very, you know, very abnormal structural pathology, it's really, really important to know where individual cells come from to really understand, you know, what might just be a normal part of the tissue and a cell might be coming from a normal part of the tissue, and what might actually be pathological. So really, this is where spatial transcriptomics came into its own. So using spatial transcriptomics, what we could really do is, you know, sit down with histopathologists, and I'm incredibly grateful for doctors Fryer and Dr. Beef, who really helped us with this. You know, so we could really sit down together, look at the histology of the fistula, and say, you know, what's going on in this part of the tissue? What's going on in that part of the tissue? Where's the leading edge of the fistula tract? What exactly should we target? And this was really helpful because we could really, you know, look in the tissue and look where the action was and map out, you know, what was happening at the multicellular molecular level precisely at those lesion edges. So on the other hand, while transcriptomic technologies like that are really, really powerful and really lets us see what's happening in cells, in fistula, what's happening outside of cells, i.e. in the extracellular matrix at protein level, is probably equally important in helping us understand pathology. So, you know, adding a layer of multiplexed immunofluorescence and looking at protein expression, looking at collagen imaging of the extracellular matrix and putting all of that together really enabled us to look at the environment of these pathogenic cells. So, you know, we could see how these cells actually sort of reshape their environment as well. For example, we could see sort of borders in tissue where cells would secrete enzymes that would break down extracellular matrix, and we could see the corresponding regions where this matrix was broken down as these pathogenic fibroblasts were really carving the way through the tissue. You know, we could see the precise areas where they are tunneling through the muscle wall of the bowel. We could see where in other areas where these cells would switch off all of these remodeling programs and instead switch on matrix deposition programs, and then that corresponded with a lot more fibrosis and stiffening of the matrix. So really that, you know, almost gave you like a local microenvironment functional readout of what a cell is doing and how it's actively reshaping the tissue that it's sitting in.
My next question is about the what you have called the fast fibroblasts. Firstly, what is fast fibroblasts? And then the question is that these fast fibroblasts are organized in concentric rings around the fistula tract, each zone doing something different, perhaps proliferating and tunneling or remodeling or laying down the fibrotic scalp. So how did you discover that spatial architecture, and what does it tell us biologically about the life cycle of fistula?
So yeah, so fast fibroblasts, we call them fast as a shorthand for just fistula-associated stroma. We think they're really several types or other states of, you know, inflammatory fibroblasts that we see in other contexts in inflammation, but have really, really specialized to to drive changes in the local microenvironment. So, for example, we see a particular state of these cells right at the lesion edge of the fistula. And here these cells are the most active. You know, they make a lot of, for example, factors that would break down the matrix. They express a lot of genes that would be associated with migration and proliferation. So we know that they're probably helping propagate the fistula at the leading edges. They also express a lot of molecules that would recruit immune cells to the edge of the lesion, and so probably actually help propagate inflammation in this area. And as we sort of move away from the lesion edge, these cells sort of start acquiring phenotypes which enable them to deposit additional collagen instead of actually chewing up the collagen in the microenvironment. And so what we think is happening is that just a little bit away from the lesion edge, these cells are then trying to reinforce the fistula tract by depositing, you know, almost like a fibrotic scar. And what this means is that the fistula tract gets reinforced, this doesn't really, it really stabilizes the tract and doesn't help it heal. If you think about it, the process that we describe is really, it's really the cycle of normal wound healing that you would have in different parts of the body. It's just that it's wound healing gone wrong. It's wound healing fibroblasts which have gone on a march in the wrong direction. Instead of closing the wound, they're breaking up tissue and creating the, you know, the wound and perpetuating it.
It's a very nice analogy for that. And speaking of triggers of the fistula, one of the interesting observations that you report is that fibroblasts have switched on transcription factors, things such as Twist1 or OSR2 or PRRX1 or RANX2 that normally shouldn't be active. So the question is that how do you think that switch gets triggered in the first place, and what is it about the inflammatory environment of Crohn's lesion that permits this developmental reprogramming?
These transcription factors do a lot of different things. For example, we know that some of them control more pro-inflammatory signaling that these fibroblasts are doing. So checking out chemokines that would attract immune cells, for example. Others, for example, like Twist1, appear to control a lot more pro-fibrotic actions of these cells. It's difficult to say how they get switched on. Our favorite hypothesis, and it's probably not too far off, is that because Crohn's disease really is multiple cycles of chronic inflammation. And that, you know, that potentially leads to the same fibroblasts getting activated and reactivated during multiple bouts of inflammation. They're exposed to, you know, to signals from their environment that, you know, signal stress, injury, inflammation. And so probably over multiple bouts of chronic inflammation, they potentially acquire epigenetic memory that, you know, sort of makes them dysregulated and makes them respond to, you know, to intestinal injury in the way that a normal fibroblast wouldn't. But exactly what the, you know, the precise mechanisms behind that is something that we'd really like to explore.
Another striking findings that you report in the paper is the interaction between fast fibroblasts and other immune cells, including macrophage population that are SPP1 positive. creating what sounds like a self-reinforcing loop. Can you crosstalk what are fibroblasts telling to macrophages and vice versa, and why does that loop matter therapeutically?
So if you think about a fistula tract, in many cases, you can have a fistula tract that is covered by epithelium, or a fistula tract that is potentially in its earlier stages where it's not covered by epithelium yet, and is really exposed to the intestinal environment, and that means that means a lot of bacteria, a lot of foreign antigens. And at the edge of the lesion, where we have fistula fibroblasts, it obviously makes sense that we also have a lot of immune cells to defend against these pathogens. Obviously, you need macrophages play a really, really big role in wound healing. Not only to act as innate defense cells, but also to really, clean up debris in the area. And macrophages also help, can also help remodel matrix. So it's really interesting, this crosstalk between these populations, because we can see that fast fibroblasts at the edges of fistula actually upregulate a lot of chemokines that would recruit these macrophages to the area. And then on the other hand, you see these macrophages expressing a lot of molecules that would then further activate fibroblasts in the region and encourage them to deposit matrix or remodel matrix. And so you can almost end up with this pathological loop where in a healthy tissue, this loop would eventually resolve. And if you're trying to, when I say in a healthy tissue, I mean in a normal case where this loop would help wound repair, it would eventually resolve. But because you're trying to repair a wound in the wrong direction with a fistula, it generally doesn't very easily resolve. And so you can end up with this sort of self-reinforcing loop of the cells telling, with cells basically encouraging each other. But it's really interesting because, these macrophage populations have been reported across other organs and other diseases, especially in fibrotic diseases as well. So it's quite interesting to see actually that potentially, you have the same processes going wrong that are causing multiple different pathologies in different parts of the organs. And I think it would be really, really nice if, rather than studying these diseases in isolation, to really pay a little bit more attention what is happening in other organ systems. Because I think some people have had great ideas. For example, in the lung, people have studied these macrophages for a lot longer than we have in the gut, even though and they know a lot more about them than we do. So I think it's a sort of we would really benefit from collaborating with people working on different organs and diseases and not to really silo ourselves a little bit so we don't end up repeating other people's work just in a different organ system.
Sure. Yeah, it's fascinating. And along the line of what you said, you also report traces of fast-like fibroblasts at the base of ulcers in patients who haven't yet developed fistula. So the question here is that how confident are you that these cells are genuinely precursor to fistula rather than bystander responses, and what would it take to prove it clinically?
Well, it's a reasonable hypothesis, isn't it? I think it would be quite hard to prove beyond a doubt. You'd obviously need, lineage tracing, and you could never do that in humans, and we'd need advanced tissue or animal models. I think our data, you know, genuinely does support this particular hypothesis, because while we see these cells in the bases of ulcers, we were also extremely fortunate to capture some very, very rare samples of fistula where basically where you can capture a really early stage fistula, what we call a fishing ulcer. So basically where you have a lesion that has penetrated a little bit into the bowel wall, already past your sort of muscularis mucosa layer, but hasn't really made a full fistula tunnel. And so, you know, that gives us a little bit of a context as to how you go from an early stage lesion to a full-blown fistula. And when we look at these early lesions and when we look at ulcers, which may or may not heal, we can see that actually the main common thing between them is these fibroblasts lining precisely this really small early lesion. And we can see that there are actually quite a few differences, even though they're very similar. There are quite a few differences between these cells and ulcers and in full-blown fistula. So we think that, you know, somewhere along the way, again, potentially from multiple bouts of inflammation, these cells probably, you know, become maybe a little bit more, you know, ambitious in how they tackle wound healing, maybe a bit more migratory, or maybe just lose their direction and start attempting to repair these lesions in the wrong direction. And this is probably where, you know, fistula, or at least some fistula, likely come from. But, you know, as I said previously, to really prove that, one would really need much more advanced models. And this is actually maybe one of our more blue sky ambitions: to can we build a model of a fistula in a dish, and then you can play with it. Then you can, you know, overexpress various pathogenic fibroblast factors and see what happens.
Well, I'm sure that day will come, and that will be fascinating. So as I said, this is a very rich study, and we can talk hours about findings and discoveries of this. But if it's okay with you, I would like to switch the gear and talk a little bit about implications of this study and what does it mean to patients' care. And in that regard, my first question is that if fast fibroblasts are the drivers of fistula formation, the obvious clinical ambition is to target them. But these cells also seem to have regenerative properties. How do you think about therapeutic challenges of switching off the destructive behaviors without destroying their repair functions? Is it a solvable problem?
It's really tricky. I think because they do so many different things in different contexts, and some of them we want to keep and some of them you want to switch off. The first step is obviously understanding what they do. And I think we've come, we've come some way towards that. But you say regenerative properties, and I'd like to say that actually in the context of fistula, the regenerative properties is a bit of a double-edged sword. This is something that you don't want. So if you would normally say, should we have some molecules that would encourage barrier repair and inflammation? You'd think, great, that's fantastic, that's what I want. But in the case of fistula, that's actually quite harmful and can really jeopardize fistula healing. Because, for example, if you encourage re-epithelialization of the tract, i.e. barrier repair, in a fistula tract, it actually stabilizes a fistula and prevents them from closing. This is what you don't want. Whereas if you have, just a lesion in your normal intestinal mucosa, yes, you want those regenerative signals to help repair that. So really, it's important where you have the regenerative signal. To answer that question, perhaps local drug delivery methods, for example, topical applications could really work here because you could actually target these pathways where you want to target them and spare the parts of the gut where you don't want them.
Transcription factors you have identified, TWIST1 and OSR2, for example, are developmental regulators expressed across many tissue. Do you think this can be targeted specifically in the gut without causing any problem?
Not easily. As you mentioned, they do a lot of different things in the body. In fact, they're not even not entirely fibroblast specific. So, for example, we know that TWIST1 can be active in some regulatory T cells as well. And if you indiscriminately target it in fibroblasts in the gut, you might have you might actually harm some cell populations that would, for example, like regulatory T cells, dampen inflammation. And that could be a very, very double-edged sword. For us, these transcription factors are really interesting from understanding the basic biology of these cells and how the broader regulation of these functions and programs in these cells are happening. But in terms of targeting them, I do think it would be quite difficult to do so specifically.
Thank you. Thinking of broader applications and transfer knowledge about this study. So this study is restricted to Crohn's disease fistula. And if my understanding is correct, the biology you are describing, that fibroblasts reverting to embryonic reprograms, forming biological niches with immune cells, sounds like it could be relevant far beyond IBD. Where else do you think this framework might apply?
So that's a great question, actually, because the obvious sort of parallels that you can draw here is between other fibrotic diseases. And really, how the process of collagen deposition and remodeling can happen. We know from previous studies, for example, that fibroblasts in the gut and other organs have a lot of parallels. If we think about the molecules that we've discovered, they have also been described in fibrosis in other organs, for example, in kidney. So I think really I mentioned before that there are a lot of parallels between different diseases. Beyond that, I think it's actually quite a fascinating insight into how wound healing in the intestine really happens, because I think normally we sort of think about it with a really big focus on barrier repair and how one would close a bigger a lesion is really fascinating. So I think one thing that we found from this is the ability of these fibroblasts to encourage sort of very focal and local epithelial regeneration. So, in the fistula tract, as you go along the tract, these fibroblasts start secreting molecules which would encourage epithelial regeneration, and so you see, that these fibroblasts can almost be dragging this, re-epithelialization, just a little bit behind them to close the tract. And I think that's really interesting when, we think about how the processes of wound healing happen in the gut, but also in other diseases. So when we initially looked at these fibroblasts and thought, hey, is this just wound healing gone wrong? We thought, you know, what other examples of wound healing are there in literature that we can draw on? And so we went and looked in skin in people who have diabetic ulcers. And what's quite fascinating there is that there are a lot of parallels between healing and non-healing ulcers in skin and these fibroblast populations that we see in fistula. And so I think, you know, a lot of biology in different areas is really, you know, sort of quite copy-paste, really. You know, it's not efficient to invent something new. You wouldn't have a very different repair process in one part of the body and in another one unless you really needed something different. So I think, you know, what we've learned here, I think is very, very transferable to a lot of other areas.
Very fascinating. And the last question of this section, you have made the entire data set publicly available. What are you hoping other scientists and perhaps computational biologists or AI researchers will do with it that your own group hasn't done it yet?
Hopefully a lot of things. The data is enormous. You know, we focused on fibroblasts because, you know, to us, that seemed quite interesting. I'm a big fan of fibroblasts in general, and we've done quite a bit of work and understand them reasonably well. And so that seemed, you know, quite a natural area to gravitate towards. But, you know, this is not probably the only cell that's contributing to the pathogenesis of fistula. I mean, you know, naturally, of course, you know, immune cells play a huge role. But you can even think about things like, you know, how do fistula tracts vascularize, for example? You know, how do you support this growth and remodeling? You know, how are the muscle cells actually, you know, responding to, you know, to these fibroblasts as you know, they start breaking down the matrix and carving the path? You know, these are all really interesting areas to explore, and, you know, we really hope other people can use our data in their own research and hopefully come up with insights we haven't. And, you know, in terms of AI, I think we're at a really, really fascinating point right now where, you know, as a research community, especially when it comes to omics data, we are at the point where we actually have, you know, just about sufficient volume of data to start doing some really, really interesting things. Yeah. So in terms of AI, I think as a research community, we're now at the point where, you know, in terms of omics data, we have, you know, sufficient data sets to really start doing really, really interesting things with it. And, you know, although our data set is large, it probably still isn't large enough for a lot of applications. So we really hope that, you know, other people can also come along and undertake similar studies and really, you know, refute or validate some of our results and, you know, really use some of these emerging technologies to be able to generate new insights, to, you know, maybe reason through this enormous data at a much larger scale in a less biased way, not just through the lens of basically what, you know, a team of a few humans thinks, but, you know, in a much more agnostic way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really difficult for me to think how the future, even short-term future, will look like under the light of AI and its application to multi-omics data and how we will be doing research. So for the last few minutes of this podcast, I would like to switch to positive research culture and the importance of multidisciplinary research, because I believe this study was really a great example of a collaborative project. And in that regard, my first question is that, from your point of view, what makes multidisciplinary research a success and what kills it?
I think the most critical thing is a lot of goodwill and a lot of excitement from everybody involved and actually collaborating. You know, not just involving other people tangentially because they might know X technique or they might have a resource you need, but, you know, everybody fully buying into a particular problem and everybody acting in a way such that, you know, everybody is included and has a stake as much as possible. So, you know, this particular project, you know, has really been started because of the really close collaboration we had with the clinic. So Dr. Colleen McGregor, who's, you know, one of the first authors, she regularly sees patients with fistulizing Crohn's disease in the clinic. And, you know, she was, you could see how frustrated she was by how little research had been done onto something that is so life-altering for her patients. And, you know, but to really sort of change that, you really need, and to make a study like ours happen, you really need to have buy-in and know-how, not just from, you know, the clinical side, but from molecular biologists, computational scientists, clinicians, histopathologists, and so on. So, you know, I think environment is really, really important to make it happen, because you generally need a place where multiple people can, you know, come together and generally give it their best, as opposed to just feeling tangentially involved.
Interesting. And along the line of what you said, one is that to, you know, truly everyone playing their role. And the second one is, you know, the culture is very important. So that brings me to my next question. And that is, how do you measure success in a multidisciplinary research culture and make sure everyone is playing their role and getting credit accordingly?
I think success is, you know, is obviously achieving something that everybody is proud of. You know, whether that's a publication, or, you know, or developing a tool, or I think to me success is having something that everybody involved can be genuinely proud of. You know, whether that means a publication. Or developing a tool, or, you know, actually getting some insights towards, you know, how we can potentially tackle a disease. Or at the end of the day, even if, you know, things that you do might not be a success, I think having had fun and having built collaborations and friendships and partnerships that, you know, even when things fail, actually being able to take it forward to the next thing and so on. But I get the point of your question, because, you know, as an interdisciplinary researcher yourself, you probably know that it's a difficult scientific culture question as to how do you make sure that nobody is overlooked. And for example, traditionally, wet lab biologists always, you know, carried the leadership flag in projects. I think the current scientific environment is changing a little bit. You know, shared authorships are becoming a lot more common. And I think everybody's recognizing that if you really want to bring together a large scale project, it cannot be one person doing it. I think we really, really need to think about how we can, you know, sort of cement these changes into our culture going forward. Because if we move away from that notion that one person has to lead a project, then we will have a lot more projects that actually, you know, proper teamwork, and therefore I think we'll have a lot more successful projects.
Fantastic. The next few questions is more kind of your own experience with this project. What did you like or dislike about this project the most?
Well, I think, as I said before, the best part is really being in a place where I'm at and working with the people that I get to work with every day. I think, you know, where I am in my scientific career has been entirely due to the people who have been around me, both, you know, peers and mentors. It makes me really sad, you know, to hear that sometimes people don't have such a positive experience, because I think that really, you know, makes or breaks how you view science. So I think for me, the most exciting part has just been the people I'm working with and how we tackle problems together. The part that I dislike the most, the early days were really hard. I think this is quite normal, but for example, we spent about 2 years trying to optimize spatial transcriptomics to work for our tissues with very, very little success, a lot of repeated failures. And it took a long time to actually have a breakthrough. You know, obviously this is quite normal as part of a scientific process that sometimes things just didn't work. And I think for one's own sanity, you always have to have multiple things on the go because you can't just fail and fail and fail. So I wouldn't like to repeat that part, but I'm happy that we persevered.
Okay. So, I mean, in the light of that, what do you wish someone had told you at the start?
Well, obviously, I wish somebody had told me all the things that wouldn't work and not to try them, and to try the things that did work. Maybe not. You know, it's character building. I think it's good for you to struggle sometimes.
Fair enough. And what advice would you have for PhD students sitting at the interface today?
Do you mean interdisciplinary PhD students?
Mostly, yes, yeah.
That's very hard to advise right now. I mean, we're on the verge of such change, especially in the eye, that I don't know. I guess it's a really exciting time to do science, because I think we'll have to rethink a lot about how we approach things in general. You know, just the loop of a project. I think a lot of things will become much quicker to do, but I think we'll also face a lot of challenges. So, you know, I wish I could foresee the future, but I think it's a strange time to be filled with both excitement and trepidation at what's to come.
Yeah, okay. So let me rephrase my question a little bit and link it to what you said earlier, that, you know, the first 2 years you tried quite a lot of different things and they all failed. So now you know that failure is part of research, and actually is an educational part of the research. But for PhD student, this is very depressing. And the fact that, a PhD path is not a linear path from A to B, they quickly become depressed and disappointed, and they feel that, their life goes nowhere. So what your advice would be in that regard?
I think you can train yourself out of that way of thinking. I think it's really, really beneficial to start viewing, you know, failure and to some extent also criticism that you receive as part of the process, and not really a reflection on your own self-worth or your own abilities as a scientist, because those, you know, are not necessarily related. And if you view it as part of the process, then I think, you know, then you're not so, you know, emotionally attached to the experiments when they don't work, for example, or, you know, when somebody criticizes your work, you're less likely to take it as an attack on you, but rather as, you know, as direction towards how you can improve. And so you know, so I think working on that and really not tying it to, you know, how you see yourself as a person, this is really, really important and possibly one of the best skills you can have. I won't say that I have that mastered because I think this is really difficult sometimes, but it's worth reminding yourself that it's a process and it's nothing to do with you.
That is very true indeed. Yes, and we all, experience that, just the level is different, I guess. And the very last question, any final thought you wish to finish off this episode with?
No, I think I just want to say thank you for having me on this podcast, Hashem. It's really been a pleasure talking to you. And again, I'd really like to thank all of the collaborators who made the study a success and all of the people who I've worked with over the years. You know, you're awesome.
Thank you so much, Agni. It was a great conversation. Well done to you, and congratulations to the whole team for this fantastic study with a great future for fistula patients. Thank you.